In the frame this week, renowned fashion photographer Mario Sorrenti joins us for a chat, plus a book all about magazine covers. What's not to love about that? And finally, Stack regular Jeremy Leslie will pay us a visit to preview his upcoming ModMag conference. It's a joy to behold wherever you look this week on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up on the programme, a little bit of fashion and some Kate Moss for you and Jeremy Leslie from Mag Culture. But we start the show talking about perhaps the most important part of any great magazine, the cover. Former editorial director at Hearst and EMAP, Ian Birch, is a man that knows the publishing industry inside out, and he knows a thing or two about the formula for the perfect front page. Ian looks back at the most revolutionary covers of all time in his new book, Uncovered, Revolutionary Magazine Covers, the inside stories told by the people who made them. Ian spoke to Monocle's Ferdinand Augusto Pacheco.
The cover is the most important page of any magazine. And there's an old industry saying that there's no such thing as a good magazine with a bad cover. It doesn't matter how good the inside is, if the cover doesn't work well, it's a disaster. And that's what sometimes happens when people launch magazines. They often leave the cover till the very last moment. And so my advice to anyone launching a magazine is to start the cover first and go back to it through the whole process, because it's such a hard thing to get right.
And yeah, it's true. I mean, we were talking before the interview about the current state of the magazine industry. Some people, they are nervous. But it's interesting that how they are still quite conservative when it comes to the cover, because, you know, it's all about grabbing your attention. And in times like this, perhaps they should do this more often, don't you think?
I completely agree with that. I mean, the problem is when times get tough, magazine companies tend to get very conservative. They're very nervous because, as I'm sure you know, at the moment, newsstand sales are not very healthy. So when that's the case, they become even more conservative. And so they stick to what they think are formulas, tried and tested formulas. But they sometimes don't realise that those formulas get very boring. And the audience, the reader, needs a surprise. And I think the best covers are this unusual mixture of the surprise and the familiar. So it's familiar in the sense of, oh, I recognise that magazine, but then I also am surprised by it. So you've got to balance the two. But I think particularly at the moment, a lot of magazines are so safe that they're actually losing readers because they're actually underestimating their readers' intelligence and also their need for change and variety and surprise and something to talk about. And I think that's one of the interesting things about what's happening with covers online, because covers are becoming more and more, you know, the stuff of Instagram. So often a cover will appear first on Instagram or in social media, and you can often tell straight away how that will then sell as a result.
And Ian, one of my pet hates, you were talking about, you know, how some publishers, they're quite conservative. It's funny because now there's this trend of having a subscription cover if you're a subscriber. And this, sometimes they look amazing. Yeah. And the newsstand edition is completely different. Mm. I know they might think because there's more kind of text, but why is that? Because sometimes I'm not a subscriber and then I'm like, oh my God, I want this edition.
No, it's a very good question. And it's the kind of question that is argued about almost every week in boardrooms. And has been for about the last 30, 40 years. My personal feeling, and it's my personal feeling, is that everyone should get the same. Why should a subscriber get something different or supposedly better, quote unquote, than a newsstand buyer? I mean, if anything, the newsstand buyer should get something more special because they're paying a lot more, because a subscriber basically gets it at a much reduced cost, because they use those numbers to sell advertising against. But my feeling is a cover should be good enough for the newsstand and for subscription. And I think it's kind of, again, underestimating the audience's intelligence that a subscriber somehow doesn't need cover lines simply because they paid a certain amount of money for a year or 2 years. So I think it's about every cover should be a unique event in itself, and in that way, give the reader something new.
Well, before we delve into your book, I just would like to ask a question, because you were editorial director at Hearst and IMAP as well. I mean, being that, did you always kind of spoke to the editors and say, well, show me your cover, let's see what we can do with that? Yeah. What was your experience with that? And did the sales change very much from cover to cover?
Oh, they changed dramatically, yeah. They would change dramatically. And sometimes we were completely surprised by the results, and sometimes we were very, very disappointed. The way that I would work with editors was very collaborative. So the worst thing in the world is to try and tell somebody to do something, because all editors are talented, quite sensitive people. That's why they're editors. So the last thing you do is to tell them to do something. So you work with them, and you basically, the whole idea is that it's not the best idea is the one that results from the conversation you have with them. So one idea isn't better than another. It's more, how do we make this the best possible cover? The covers are so different, and there are so many different demands. There are cover rules that have grown up over the last 10, 20, 30 years. They tend to be from mainstream magazines, general interest magazines, very much mass circulation magazines. And those rules revolve around things like eye contact. The better the eye contact, so the thinking goes, the better the sale. Also, it's much better to have a photograph than it is to have an illustration, because people prefer to see a person than to see words or a cartoon. So I could go through a whole list of those, but I would bore your listeners. But the thing about a great cover is it has those rules, if you like, in the back of its head, but it starts to change and subvert those rules. And that's where the surprise comes in. And so when I said before, a cover is that mixture of the familiar and the surprise. Often great covers are a subtle twist or a surprise or something that just immediately makes you laugh or makes you think that's really clever. So to me, sometimes the best covers are those that just change the rules very subtly, but at the same time, quite effectively.
Well, let's talk about the process to choosing, you know, the covers that you decided to feature in the book. I mean, did you want to choose perhaps the more iconic ones, right?
Well, the way this book came about was it was originally going to be a picture-based book with short captions. But actually, I thought at the beginning that was quite a boring thing to do. And so I started talking to the people who created the covers. So it became an oral history. Now, I say that because, you know, I spoke to the editor, I spoke to the art director, I spoke to the photographer and so on. I didn't speak to the celebrity. I spoke to the people who actually did the covers. And so it evolved that the best stories got into the book. So they're not necessarily the most beautiful covers or the most extraordinary covers. They're those covers that have the best stories behind them. So quite often, they are the result of breaking all sorts of rules. I put it together in the end when I picked the 70, 80 best stories that I had, because I interviewed over 160 people. And it ended up, what I wanted was a cover that was like a social document, that was a snapshot of a time. And so it was not just a moment in the history of the magazine. It was actually a moment in social, cultural, even political history. So that's why I think it's kind of different to most other books about magazine covers.
Well, I'm very glad you haven't only done like a picture book, you know, because, you know, it was interesting to read some of the stories. And even, you know, I wouldn't say perhaps it's the most iconic cover of time, of all time, but a really interesting story, that one from 2012, Are You Mum Enough? Where there's a picture of, you know, a woman breastfeeding her, I believe, 3-year-old. And, yeah, and it caused so much controversy, a lot of negative attention as well. So that's the problem of a cover, is though it can also attract quite a lot of backlash.
Absolutely it can, but I think what a great cover does is a cover actually triggers a debate. And I think a great cover is one that sparks a conversation. That to me is something that is of great value. So, I mean, it's great if you do a fabulous cover of Vogue and everyone goes, isn't that beautiful? And of course, it probably is very beautiful. There's nothing much beyond that. Whereas to me, a cover has far more resonance. It has far more value. It has far more significance if it triggers a conversation. And sometimes covers are like rallying calls. They come up with something new and it attracts a new kind of way of thinking about things. Sometimes covers anticipate things that are about to happen without realizing it. And then sometimes covers are the kind of covers that they capture a mood or they memorialize an event. So if you take something like 9/11, which obviously was a catastrophe, some of the American covers were quite extraordinary in the way they captured the mood of America at that time. And they tried to understand what happened. And that's, for example, what the New York Times did and the New Yorker did. What I'm trying to say, I guess, in a slightly long-winded way is those covers that spark a really meaningful reaction in their reader, to me, is a great cover.
Do you think nowadays the magazines that actually are doing well when it comes to covers are actually the news magazines?
Yes.
And funnily enough, they're the ones who are seeing their circulation rise. And I stopped here on page 36 of your book, Private Eye, as well, which, funnily enough, they continue to create amazing covers, every new issue. But this one here, I think it's Winston Churchill,
It's
right?
Winston Churchill, yes.
Fantastic cover.
Yeah, that's Gerald Scarfe, very famous, as you know, cartoonist and artist. And he did that cover. It's a very, very sad picture of Churchill because if you look carefully, his hands are turning into those of a skeleton. So the poor old man was so close to death. It was his very last time in the House of Commons. And I interviewed Gerald Scarfe about it. And he said when he saw him being helped in, because everyone's idea of Churchill was this great, strong bulldog, the person who defeated Hitler and so on. And by this stage, he was so old and so frail, and it was so, so sad to see him, such a old man. And in fact, he did that cover, that drawing originally for the Times newspaper. But when the Times saw it, they said they couldn't possibly publish it because his wife would be so upset. So Gerald Scarfe then gave it to Private Eye, who immediately put it on the cover.
That's amazing. And Ian, I just would like to hear from you. We spoke about news magazines. I was going to ask, which magazines do you think are doing well when it comes to covers? If not a title, which group of magazines?
Well, I think to your point, news magazines are doing well because people want trusted outlets at the moment. Because what with Trump and Brexit and everything else going on, people need trusted sources of information because of fake news and so on. So as a result of that, things like The Economist is doing very well. Private Eye has never sold better. But at the same time, interestingly, because it takes a very strong stand on certain things like Brexit, it faces more abuse from people than it's ever faced before. I think one really interesting magazine is Time in America. Time has really gone through a renaissance in terms of its covers. They are so passionate. And there's a Cuban-American artist called Adele Rodriguez, you might know, who's kind of a genius, I think. Well, not kind of. He is a genius. And he's been doing these extraordinary covers based around Trump. And they are absolutely unforgiving about Trump because he was an immigrant himself. And so obviously everything that Trump was proposing around immigrants was something he took very personally and very seriously. But that's just one element of the whole Trump agenda. And his covers, I think, have been extraordinary. And they're almost like political art done through an emoji sensibility. So if you look at his covers, Trump is this orange blob with a kind of open mouth. And he's taken that. So they do very well online because they look like emoji. And he's used that as a basis to develop this graphic more and more. And he now does stuff for Der Spiegel. He does stuff for French magazines. He obviously does Time. And the other thing he does, which is interesting because he's a political artist, is that he makes his art available online so you can download it. So quite often, if you look at pictures of demonstrations, you'll see his artwork on placards that people are carrying in demonstrations. So it's sort of this interesting thing of this new kind of political art.
That was Ian Birch, author of Uncovered, which is published by Octopus and is out now. In fact, Ian Birch, from whom you just heard, will be one of the guests at ModMag this year, the annual magazine conference hosted by Jeremy Leslie from Mag Culture. The event this year takes place on the 1st of November. Jeremy stopped by at Midori House to give us a little preview of what to expect.
So this will be the 6th London edition, and we also did a New York edition earlier this year, our first New York one. So it's the 7th one we've done, and it's not that it gets easier, but it gets simpler in a sense. It gets simpler, you know what you're doing, and every year is different. There's a different mix of people. You know, and one of the key things we do is look back through what we've written about in the journal over the last year and pick out one or two things that we think have been highlights. And it depends what's been happening. But there's a very clear theme formed this year, which is about reinvention. So we've got the creative director of National Geographic coming over to talk about their complete relaunch, their graphic relaunch of the whole magazine earlier this year. But then we've also got the founder of Ion Design, Perrin Drum, coming over from New York, who's going to talk about changing what they do. Well, not changing, but adding to what their very successful website, adding a print edition. So, you know, various forms of kind of reinventing what you're doing is the theme. So once you have the theme, then it all kind of falls, it sort of rolls into place somehow. It all hangs on that theme.
Well, and it's interesting because I wonder, I mean, we'll talk a bit more about some of the other speakers who are going to be appearing. You can maybe run us through, with the caveat there may be still one or two late-breaking editions, which would be very exciting. But this idea that, you know, we remain in an industry that needs to be innovative, that needs to be flexible, that maybe needs a bit of reinvention. And that's no bad thing. And it doesn't mean, and I guess this is a theme people will pick up on, it doesn't mean casting out the traditional values, the things that a brand like, say, National Geographic is known for. It's about supplementing it, adding to it.
Contemporary, but not losing, as you say, is something like National Geographic. We do a number of interviews on the journal where we talk to people about their formative years in magazines. And National Geographic is the magazine that so many people grew up with and it's first sort of informed them of what a magazine was. And you don't want to lose that kind of basic essence. But at the same time, if a magazine stands still, it'll just fade away. And we've seen that happen with magazines. I think too many of the big publishers have sort of got obsessed by digital and sort of lost the flow of what they were doing. And I think people are all turning back to that now. And it's a very exciting time for that reason. But you can't stand still. That's the key.
Well, let's discuss some of the speakers. I mean, I don't know how much you want to give away in terms of what exactly they'll be covering. but run us through some. I mean, there must be particular people that you're always especially
excited. Well, I mentioned some of the people. I mentioned Perrin and Iron Design. But another magazine that launched this year was A Dance Mag. From Beirut, and so the editor and founder of that, Jana El Obedin, is joining us. Very excited about that. She's made one magazine. There's one issue of this magazine, but it's a very interesting, great launch issue of a new idea for a magazine. So very keen to hear from these new and importantly young people making these magazines. And then we've also got, and in the similar sort of spirit, and very much talking about kind of reinvention in the sense of looking back and looking forward, Ian Birch, whose book Uncovered is out this week. We're very excited to have him joining us, but rather than just have him deliver highlights from the book, we've asked him to select 10 covers from his book and highlight why they're important. But then we've got the editor of Varoom magazine, Olivia Ahmed, coming to talk in response to that, updating some of the themes and noting what people are doing with front covers today, which relate back to some of the kind of classic covers that Ian is talking about. We've got a series of talks from very good magazine makers, but every year we try and bring in something a little bit different, and that's the extra this year.
And tell us a bit about where this is happening, and maybe if our listeners aren't familiar with the previous iterations, tell us a bit about the sort of the mood, I suppose, of ModMag. It's very friendly. It feels like there's conversations going on. It's not a sort of starchy thing where there's the delegates.
It's very deliberately different. I mean, one of the reasons we first sort of launched the whole idea was to get away from the kind of industry organisation, sort of professional sort of suit and tie thing, which is very hidebound.
I've never seen a collar and tie there, I'm pretty sure.
We don't ban them, but...
So you can if you want. Everyone is welcome, it's true.
Maybe in a few years' time. No, but it is very friendly. It's a celebration. Fundamentally, I mean, I always introduce the day and talk about it as being a celebration, albeit with serious intent underlying it. But it's a celebration and a reminder of the power and the innovation and the excitement that it continues to exist within magazine publishing. there's always some bad news. I mean, just last year during the conference itself, the news broke that Teen Vogue was closing. I mean, that's the situation the industry's in, and we're used to that. But there's enough good news, and every year we want to share and celebrate that good news. And it's an informal environment, it's friendly, it's open. We get a lot of people who make magazines coming to attend and learn from people speaking. It's a buzz. It's a good day out, I would say.
And I guess even if it's a classic thing, even if one person in the audience goes out and finally realises their dream of getting something started, it kind of works. And to that point about closures, I suppose, even just this year, we've had other titles where they close to much sort of wringing of hands and collective sighs and sorrow. But it seems to almost remind people what they might be losing. And that galvanises people, whether it's Interview or Vogue Om, to then reboot it and give it some the fresh attention it needs. So in a way, you can have this sort of, you know, Lazarus-like sort of rekindling.
You know, we're celebrating the culture of magazines. And I think, you know, you can always zero in on single editions and single publications. And that's, they've all got their stories and their ups and downs. But we're interested in the broader culture of what's happening. And I'm very positive about it because magazines, they always come and go. It's the nature of it. It's like any endeavour. There's magazines that are big and successful. There are magazines that are kind of seem to be slipping and losing their mojo. Then they come back, and it's just this perpetual reinvention.
We keep coming back to that. He's very good, isn't he? Now, remind our listeners where they can find out more. I mean, I guess probably a handful of tickets still available. Can people find out more?
The full lineup and all the information and tickets are available on our website, magculture.com. We have got some tickets left. They're going fast, so get in there. We have the regular tickets, we have student tickets, if you're interested in group rates. We get quite a lot of businesses sending groups of, you know, their teams along. So, come along. It's going to be a lovely day.
Thanks, Jeremy. Make sure to book your ticket. You can find more details on magculture.com, and we'll be covering the event here on the programme, so watch this space for more in a few weeks' time. Finally, on this week's programme, we meet Italian-born photographer and director Mario Sorrenti. His work's been featured in Vogue, W Magazine and Harper's Bazaar, to name but a few. He's just launched a new book featuring previously unreleased photographs of one Kate Moss, who happens to be his former girlfriend. It's a beautiful and intimate volume. Fernando went to meet him. Mario told Faye all about the book and about his approach to fashion photography.
I was studying painting at school and sculpture, a school of visual arts. Through some friends, I came across photography. They were studying photography, and I just fell in love with photography at that point. I was living in New York. It was 1989. Once I discovered photography, I dropped painting, and I dropped out of school, and I was like, that's it. I'm just going to take pictures. I want to learn how to do photography, and I started modeling, and I met a model agent and modeling a little bit in New York here and there. And I started taking some pictures of some models and stuff in New York. And then my agent was like, oh, why don't you go to Europe and, you know, try and make some money in Europe? You know, there's a lot of models there and there's a big market there and stuff. And I was like, okay, that'd be great. You know, I'd love to go and discover England and France and... So I went. It was actually on a modeling job here in London that I met Kate for the first time. I was 19 years old. My heart just stopped. It was like, wow, oh my God. This girl's amazing. And she was funny and quirky and beautiful. And then I didn't see her for a while again. And then we met up again through some friends and stuff a couple of months later. And a few months after that, we started dating.
The pictures we see in the book, at what stage did you ever thought that you were going to release them to the world?
The pictures in the book were all shot between 1991 and 93. There's like about two or three pictures that I had printed before that had kind of been around a little bit, but never really published in any books or anything. All the rest of the photographs just sat in my archives for 20 years until about 10 years ago, my wife started archiving and digitizing all my film and putting everything in order. And she came across all the photographs and she was like, you should really see these pictures. They're great. And I was like, oh, but didn't really have much interest. And then I kind of like looked at them, and then I showed them to a friend of mine that I was working with, Dennis Friedman, who is amazing creative director that I was working with a lot. And he flipped out over the pictures. He was like, wow, these are amazing. You have to do something with it. So we started editing the pictures together just to see if there was anything really good there, really photographically relevant. Once we started seeing all the work come together, we were like, wow, this is great. There's something really beautiful here. Let's do a book. He came to me and he was like, oh, I'm working with Fiden, and this would be a great home for those photographs. Then we just got into printing and stuff.
And what was Kate's reaction about the pictures? Did she like to enjoy this kind of...
Yeah, for her it was very sweet. It was like looking back at all the pictures and remembering those years and those times. And, you know, oh, I remember when that happened or this or that. And she really loved the pictures and really enjoyed looking at them. And also really understood the body of work and what we had edited together. And I think she was very supportive and gave us her blessing and stuff.
Clearly she was your muse at the time. And do you think she influenced your work, you know, after this shoot as well?
Kate and I were together. We were living together. We grew up together in those 3 years a lot. We both started with nothing and then both began our careers. That was something that you kind of never forget in your life. You know, we were a big part of each other's careers and lives. And then we continued to work together through the last 20 years, 25 years and stuff. So, and we remained good friends. So we've influenced each other a lot. Imagine living with somebody who's like completely obsessed with photography and constantly absorbing everything about it and the artists and the art of photography and everything. So inevitably, you're going to start looking at what you do as a model in photography in a completely different way. For me, coming from America and coming here to England and meeting a girl like Kate who was had so much style and she was so cool and simple and easy, and it was like, and that was a big influence on me as well from a cultural and stylistic point of view and stuff. So we had a very powerful exchange of who we were and also a very powerful bond, I think.
Well, and you can see that in the pictures in a way. And Mario, just a question. I mean, the book is a thing of beauty, wonderful pictures, wonderful format as well. I was wondering, are you still very much in love with print in general? Because, of course, you work for several magazine titles. Do you still have that passion? Do you still think perhaps print is still king?
Yeah, for me, I love print. I love it so much. And just the idea that it might disappear one day just breaks my heart. And I don't think it will, because there is just nothing like holding a print in your hand, whether it's a magazine, a book, an actual photographic print. I love to see my work printed in magazines and in books. It's very intimate.
You're very right, because people say, oh, print is dying, perhaps in the world of newspapers. But when it comes to fashion, I think there is something to be said about touching, you know, a magazine and looking at a photo shoots by you, for example, or any other great photographer. Do you think, I think fashion would be safe for now when it comes to print in a way?
Yeah, I think so. There's a lot of magazines that are coming out. There's such an incredible saturation of magazines, and every day you think people are saying, oh, it's going to disappear, and then you see another magazine appearing and stuff. So let's say digital media does take over at one point. I don't think magazines will completely disappear. Actually, I think they will become more treasured and more important.
That was Mario Sorrenti talking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Kate, published by Fiden, is out now. That is all we have time for on this week's programme. Thanks to our ever-busy producer, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our editors, Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. Comments and queries should be sent to Fernando. You can find him on fp@monocle.com. To end this week's stack, let's hear a track with vocals by none other than Kate Moss herself. This is Some Velvet Morning, performed by Primal Scream and Kate Moss. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.